All right, I guess we'll get ready to get started here. I'm Ivan Penn. I'm the utilities reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. And this session is nukes, fossil fuels, and alternatives, what will power our future. We do have one unfortunate regret, as Mark Cooper's flight was canceled, so he won't be joining us today. Apparently there was a mechanical failure. So, with our government shutdown and no inspectors, that's not a good mix. I personally drove up here. So for the rest of you who are on flights, cross your fingers, say your prayers. But we are joined by Dan Stout, who is a senior manager of TVA's Small Modular Reactor Project. We have Stephen Smith from the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy as the executive director there. And we have Richard Meyer with the American Gas Association. They're going to give introductory remarks. We'll have a conversation about what will power our future. And then we will open up the floor to questions, journalists first. And please post questions, limit the commentary, and identify yourself when that time does come. So if we're all ready, we're going to start to my far right and have Dan Stout kick us off.
All right, thanks. The program shows Joe Hoagland speaking. Joe sends his regrets, and he sends me. And I hope you don't regret that. It's a privilege to be here representing Tennessee Valley Authority. We're the utility that generates electricity that not only supplies the lights here, but in the 7-state region, 9 million customers. And we have a long-range plan that's been well communicated. And that's to be one of the nation's leaders in low-cost clean energy by 2020. And so that's going to require some changes to our generating portfolio. That means less coal. It means more natural gas, nuclear, renewables. And some actions have been taken on that vision already, and more to come. We have a focus on a balanced portfolio, and that balanced portfolio is in the best interest of our customers, and it has more resiliency when things change. Natural gas has more volatility in the fuel price. So all the different generating sources have their pros and cons, and so balance is the way to go. Hydro is one of our assets here in the Valley. We just announced that we had a record year in 2013, more hydroelectricity generated than in our 80-year history. So I work in our technology innovation area. We have three main thrusts in that area. One is grid modernization. Another is electricity utilization, things like electric vehicles. So it was a good panel early morning breakfast. Good to see all the different types of electric vehicles and the growth there. And small modular reactors, and that's my area. At TVA, we have six large nuclear reactors, and I'm working in the... Again, this technology innovation area, looking into the future of what type of nuclear energy makes sense. And these small modular reactors truly are an innovation in nuclear energy. These are designed, post 9/11, considering the impacts of Fukushima. These are more secure, more safe. It incorporates features like all of the nuclear components being fully underground. It takes security elements like aircraft impact off the table by design. It's easier to defend a facility against intentional destructive acts if you're factoring that in the design and the plants underground. The small modular reactor, let's talk about small. We're talking, the one that we are evaluating is 180 megawatts, and compare that to about a 1,200 megawatt reactor that we have in our current fleet. You're looking at roughly 15% of the size. The modular is referring to the type of construction, and the intent is to take more of the construction out of the site and put it into a factory setting, and then ship by truck or by rail components to the site that get assembled. And so you have more of the manufacturing being done through automation that's repeatable. You have tighter tolerances, you have better quality assurance, more repeatability on how it's manufactured. And that also results in a shorter construction time, which is one of the keys to keeping the overall capital cost down. The nature of these projects are long, and if your construction duration takes a long time, your financing costs accumulate. So shorter construction times, lower financing costs. You also have a smaller footprint, and our hope is that this type of smaller footprint would enable use in things like repowering coal plants and things like that. It's important that there's a fleet. The concept of standardization in a fleet is one of the keys to a better operating cost long term, where a worker who's trained on a nuclear reactor can go to another one and it operates exactly the same. Today, all of our reactors are different. They're unique. So this commitment to the modularization, the standardization, the constructor being involved in the design so that when you build a plant, it becomes repeatable. And it's more like how gas plants are built today. So a lot of lessons learned on how to do this type of manufacturing. We're in the process of doing the environmental characterization and the licensing. And that includes extensive data gathering. We're doing endangered species surveys, cultural resource surveys. We're doing the subsurface investigation. That's you drill holes down into the rock to understand the nature, the behavior from responding to a seismic event. All that data and analysis is feeding into the design, and it's feeding into a license application. In 2 years, we'll submit that license application to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They'll review it independently for 3 years. At the end of that, they issue a license. We can begin construction. The construction schedule is roughly 3 years. So, if we stay on track, we're talking about a schedule to have this plant operational in 2022. So all this is gathering of data, developing a license, making sure it's safe, making sure public health and safety is protected as part of a decision process. So we haven't made a decision to build yet. That's something in the future. If all the data comes together, it's acceptable, and the business case makes sense, then there'll be a construction decision. So I'm an option development. If you want any details, we have some information available after the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Now we'll turn to Stephen Smith of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy.
Great. Thank you, Ivan, and thanks for the opportunity to share a little bit about what we do and our perspective on things. I'm, again, Stephen Smith. I'm the Executive Director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. We're a regional nonprofit energy policy and environmental advocacy organization that does work primarily in the Southeast United States. Our sandbox or footprint is pretty much the TVA region, which is TVA, Tennessee, a little bit of Kentucky, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. We do work in the Carolinas, North and South Carolina, and we also do work in Florida. We have five sort of what I call macro programmatic focuses that we really are specialize in. looking at climate policy, climate strategies for dealing with global warming, energy efficiency, renewable energy, clean fuels, which initially was looking at a lot of biofuels, but we've been doing a lot more work on electric vehicles for transportation. And then we have an area that we call high-risk energy choices that we're less enthusiastic about, and that's looking at things like coal-fired power plants, nuclear power plants, and we're not big fans of offshore drilling that we've experienced some impacts here as of late. We have offices throughout the Southeast. I have maybe about 30 people that work for me, and what I wanted to share our thoughts and perspective on is that this is really an exciting time in the electric power sector. It is a time where a lot of things are coming together at a point. You have a lot of innovation that's happening, particularly in the renewable space, in things like storage. You have historically unprecedented low natural gas prices that I'm sure we'll hear more about. You have a significant drop in decline due to the economy that coming out of this very significant recession. But you also have a real technology input looking at where energy efficiency has really transformed technologically how we use energy. And that is leading to, again, downward pressure on growth in the electric sector. And in our opinion, that actually creates opportunities for utilities to rethink how they do business. And historically, utilities were always sort of chasing demand growth. They were very concerned about getting enough capacity on the ground so that they had the reliability and the lights never went out. They can take more of a breather now because a lot of that pressure is off. You also have a much greater awareness about the implications of some of the fuel choices that we've made. The science behind climate change is undeniable. Last week's release of the IPCC policy statement and the reports that are coming out just further solidify that science. And anyone who I believe is really spent any time looking at the science, there's really no controversy about the science anymore. They're talking 95% understandings of the certainty about the human fingerprint on it. And so that is beginning to take hold. We're seeing more and more destabilization of our climate. I think more and more people are beginning to understand that something's amiss, and that I think this is going to continue to build and build in the not-too-distant future, where there's going to be more and more pressure for action. I think a lot of corporations are beginning to get that and understand it. Utilities, some are in more leadership position than others. And so you have all these things sort of converging to where the way we've done business in the utility sector is not going, historically, the way we've done business in the utility sector is really not going to be the way we do business going forward. And I do believe that some analogies may be warranted here. I believe that in a lot of ways we're kind of where, for some of the utilities, particularly ones that want to hold on to the old world view, they're going to sort of be looking at what the digital camera did to Kodak. You're going to be looking at sort of what the cell phone did to the landlines in the communication area. We're seeing this kind of accelerating pace of transformation that's really going to redefine how we produce and consume energy in this country. That said, the question is, how quickly is that going to roll out? Utilities are extremely powerful entities politically, particularly in our part of the country. Again, in our sandbox here in the Southeast, we've got Duke Energy, which is now the largest utility since their merger with Progress. We've got Southern Company, which has historically been one of the more regressive and aggressive utilities in opposing environmental regulations. We've got big entities like the Tennessee Valley Authority, and then we've got big players like NextEra and FPL in Florida. And so we've got some of the biggest utility players in the country that are in our region. And it's going to be very interesting to see how they're able to adapt. You've already heard TVA talking about their vision of a cleaner world. We've seen some very interesting transformations happening with Southern Company, where they've lost control of some of their public service commissions, and they've been mandating requirements on solar. And then we've seen in Florida, I think, sort of the continued collapse of the nuclear industry, where Duke walked away from one of their planned reactors. They had to walk away from a reactor that happened before the merger, where Crystal River was cracked during a do-it-yourself kind of exercise, where they were trying to change out a steam generator and cracked it. We called it the Humpty Dumpty reactor because they cracked it. They ended up cracking it three times before it was all said and done, before they walked away from it. And this has very serious implications, because Florida is very dependent on natural gas, and they're trying to figure out how they balance their portfolio. And so we believe that what is going to happen is that renewables and efficiency are going to play a much larger role. And I believe they're going to provide the flexibility that utilities need to be able to, going into this uncertain future, bring modular elements of new generation coupled with a way to continue to deal with the demand reduction. What we're going to have to do, though, is we're going to have to come up with ways of having the utilities figure out a new model for how they make money. Because historically, and what still is the dominant way they do it, is if they bring a large production asset, like a nuclear power plant or a big coal plant or a big natural gas plant, into their rate base, they basically get a rate of return for 40, maybe even as much as 60 years, that is in excess of 10%, sometimes approaching 12%. So I don't know where you're putting your money these days. If I have money to invest in the market and I try to find a place to make an investment, if I get a 0.5% or 1% on my investment, that I'm struggling to find those kind of investments. The utilities, if they invest, like let's say Southern Company invests $14 billion with their partners in a nuclear power plant, if you move a $14 billion asset into your rate base, and you're going to get a rate of return at close to 12% for the next 40 years, you're golden with your shareholders. And that's why you see a lot of focus on trying to get generation assets in the historic traditional utility model. What we're talking about is how do you actually get utilities to get compensated for energy efficiency, and how do you get them interested in playing in the renewables market, where it's a much more decentralized and distributed form of generation. And so these are very big questions, and there's a lot of work going on in it. There's a lot of innovation. There's also a lot of utilities that are digging in their heels. If you think about it, just this past January, the Edison Electric Institute, which is the aggregate of the big investor-owned utility models, put out a paper about the disruptive nature of distributed generation. They're very concerned that as solar begins to gain greater market share and begins to technically peel customers off of their the grid, or at least during the day off of the grid, that it's going to really transform the business model and disrupt the way that they make money. And so they're very concerned about that. So these things are coming. I believe that there are innovation and entrepreneurial forces that have been unleashed that are going to continue to have this grow, and I think it's going to put a lot of pressure on traditional utilities. I know that during the Q&A we'll get more into some of the questions about things like small modular reactors, what are the technology sources, natural gas. I do want to share with you in the back of the room, my friends at the Union of Concerned Scientists have put together a little report. Small isn't always beautiful. Sort of takes deconstructs some of the arguments that the nuclear industry is using about small modular reactors. We can get into more detail on that in the Q&A. I encourage you to pick one up, and I look forward to the conversation.
Hey, thank you, Steve. And now we're going to turn to Richard Meyer from the American Gas Association.
Good morning. It's nice to see you all, and it's a pleasure to be here representing the American Gas Association. A little bit about AGA. We are based in Washington, D.C. We are the trade association for natural gas utilities. And I differentiate utilities and split that apart. There are electric utilities and gas utilities. So our members are the gas distribution side of the business. So that is to say they are responsible for piping gas to 117 million Americans, 65 million households in the U.S. In terms of the gas industry, you know, we're at the end of the pipeline. You have producers that extract natural gas, bring it to market. You have the long-haul pipelines that will cross states or go through states with lots of natural gas, and then it goes to the distribution system, the end of the pipeline. And those are our companies, the investor-owned utilities that own and operate the millions of miles of pipeline that bring the gas to homes and businesses. So, you know, that's where we sit. Thinking about what to start with today, I'm going to wear my natural gas hat, certainly, but I think that there's a really interesting and robust conversation we can have about the unprecedented rise in clean energy across the board. Stephen mentioned energy efficiency and renewables, and I want to talk about that. Natural gas is also playing a key role here. So there are three facts that I think kind of underscore this rise in clean energy that we've seen, and I think the trends are encouraging, and I look forward to kind of getting into some of these specifics as we go forward. So the first fact is related to natural gas. The growth in natural gas production hit an all-time record last year. Growth in consumption also hit an all-time record last year. This year for 2013, consumption again is up another 0.5% above that record level last year. We'll see how that year finishes off. We're looking at another record year of natural gas production here in the United States for 2013. Number two, we had record levels of installations of electric generation capacity from renewables last year, in particular on wind and on solar. You had about almost 13 gigawatts of wind capacity installed last year, a little over 3 gigawatts of solar, and renewables as a total component, including hydro and others, were the single largest source of new electric generation capacity last year. So, to me, those two facts starting off, we have, a rise in natural gas production and an increased use of natural gas, lower natural gas prices, but simultaneous to that, we're also seeing a rise in renewables. So they're not actually working against each other per se. Now, there are different reasons that both of these phenomena are happening, but nevertheless, they are both happening. Number three is kind of the consequence of these two factors and energy efficiency. We've seen a tremendous decline in greenhouse gas emissions, in particular carbon dioxide emissions, over the last few years. Let me make sure I get my numbers right. Last year, in terms of CO2, from fossil fuel combustion, CO2 emissions were at 1994 levels by the end of 2012. This is about 10 or 11% below 2007 levels, and that was the peak, the all-time peak of carbon dioxide emissions in this country prior to the recession. Now, the recession did have something to do with bringing down carbon dioxide emissions, certainly as the economy shrank and folks were using less energy and businesses were shuttering, there was less demand for energy and therefore lower greenhouse gas emissions. However, in 2012, the economy was bigger in real terms than it was in 2007, and we saw a decrease still of 11-12% of carbon dioxide emissions. What that says to me is we've kind of decoupled economic growth from our growth in greenhouse gas emissions, and I think that's a tremendous stride forward as we think about reducing the environmental impacts of our energy usage. So, kind of acknowledging these facts, and I think that the industry trends, especially in the natural gas side, are encouraging, and that I think the trends do support the case for greater use of natural gas to meet our energy goals. I think natural gas can help us meet our environmental goals, support our economic goals, and help improve our national energy security. Coming back to the natural gas distribution side, one topic that has emerged over the last year and I think will continue to be an important one on the environmental side is the issue of natural gas emissions. And these are, natural gas released from whether the production side, the transmission and processing, or the eventual distribution. And I just want to give some numbers related to that because I think what we see when we dig into the data is that we see a relatively small natural gas emissions footprint and therefore greenhouse gas emissions footprint and an ever-improving one. The natural gas distribution sector added over 300,000 miles of new pipeline. That's a 30% increase since 1990. But natural gas emissions declined 16% in total terms over that time. So while the system was expanding, it was also getting much better. This is due to improvements and modernization of technologies, new plastic pipe installed that releases less natural gas emissions than older unprotected steel, for example. And better practices as well. Voluntary programs such as the EPA Natural Gas STAR program have also contributed to a lower emissions profile from the industry. Overall, from natural gas systems, so this includes everything upstream from the distribution side, we've seen a decline in natural gas emissions of 10% from the industry since 1990. Now, keep in mind, last year there was a record level for production and consumption, but in total, emissions from the sector have been down 10%. So I think that's, again, an encouraging sign that the industry is improving and will continue to improve as we go forward, thus strengthening the environmental case for using natural gas to meet our goals. Last, I want to say about efficiency. Natural gas utilities are committed to efficiency. We, last year, in 2012, there was budgeted $1.4 billion in natural gas utility program funds for energy efficiency. The year prior to that was $1 billion. So went from $1 billion to $1.4 billion, saving, I don't actually have the numbers here, but saving tremendous amounts of energy and greenhouse gas emissions, CO2 emissions, as a result of these efficiency programs. Gas utilities can be committed to energy efficiency because, in large part, they are indifferent to the amount of gas going through the system. For the most part, our members make money by putting pipe into the ground and earning a regulated rate of return on that pipe. And they don't make any money, for a large part, in terms of the amount of gas going through those pipes. So as a result, they can be committed towards improving customer-side efficiency, ensuring that high-efficiency appliances for heating your water, heating your home, can be at the end of the line, so that not only is the distribution system running well and improving, but how we use the natural gas at the end of the line is also improving as well. There's a lot I kind of touched on there, and I look forward to a robust conversation and hearing from all of you out there. So thank you.
Thank you. And as we move into our discussion here, I have the first question I'm going to pose to Dan Stout. Some of you may know, those who don't, Florida is sort of the poster child for the challenges that we have in our nation on energy issues. Steve mentioned Duke Energy, which is one of the large investor-owned utilities in the state of Florida. They were the first ones this year to close a nuclear plant, the Crystal River nuclear plant, and they also canceled the Levy nuclear project that was to build an AP-1000, two AP-1000 nuclear reactors just north of the Crystal River plant, about 10 miles. But what they continue to do is to pursue the license for that nuclear plant, that in the event that natural gas prices spike, nuclear would become more viable, then they can pull that license off the shelf. So my question to you, Dan, is as you all are working on the small modular reactors, and we have a number of either delayed, suspended, or canceled big box nuclear plants, a site like Levy, what are the possibilities that that license could be taken and turned into a small modular reactor project as opposed to a big box one? And are they expandable, since it is just a percentage of a 1,200 megawatt reactor?
Good question. We are viewing it in somewhat in that way, that this is an option. Our intent on our first project at Clinch River is a demonstration. You know, what better way to reduce your risks than to focus on the technology risk, focus on the financial risk, focus on the regulatory and environmental risk? Build one. But it's expandable. So we're For example, we're obtaining a license for up to 4 reactors at Clinch River. We could very well decide to build 2 and then later expand it and have 2 more. So, you know, that's up to the owner, the utility, on what type of deployment plan that they would desire. But that's one of the attractive features, is the ability to better match demand growth and make your investment in smaller bites. It's a better risk profile for the customers. The Public Utility Commissions will view it that way, that the increment of investment better matching the demand growth. So in terms of the ability to reuse a license, a little complicated question. There are several types of licensing approaches that are available through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. One is called an early site permit. And an early site permit is one where if the utility considers all the variety of different designs possible in the environmental review, then that license can be granted, and coupled with a technical license, the safety of the design being certified, then the utility could proceed more quickly, and that review would then accommodate a shift in strategy to deployment of an SMR rather than a large light water reactor.
Well, and Steve, before you respond, what about the economies of scale? You're building a smaller reactor. You're still, you mentioned that these reactors would be underground, so you have some safety measures that you don't have with the big box reactors. But you're still going to have, obviously, the security personnel. You have your operational engineers. You have a significant number of personnel that are going to still be operating there. What about the economies of scale of operating a small modular reactor compared to a big box reactor?
Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know the details of the cost. That's part of the work that we're doing over the next couple of years. But, you know, let's take security as an example. The approach that we're taking is that this reactor needs to be protected the same or better than large light water reactors. And the way you do that is you assess the ability to protect it against your design basis threat. That's a term of art used by our regulator. And the details of that threat are classified. We don't want the terrorists to understand that, that level of detail. So, but the regulator defines that we design and staff and train to protect against that. Being underground, being designed with that threat in mind, a lower workforce, lower number of guards can defend against that. So now those numbers, we don't know yet. That's what the work that's proceeding right now is intended to do, is to try to finalize that, get the regulator to review the planned approach to meet that need, and have them make that decision. We'll know our costs after that.
So how do you respond to that, Steve?
Well, there's a number of different elements of this. You know, there's a reason why nuclear power went to the scale that it did, because ultimately what they're trying to do is they have this security and just oversight infrastructure that the goal was to spread it across as many kilowatt hours as you can. And so the theory behind the SMRs sounds well, it sounds good, but I think it's going to be, I mean, as Dan said, I think it's going to be, there's a lot of unknowns about this, because as you start to go from 1,200 or 1,000 megawatts back down to these smaller modular components, you still have a significant security infrastructure. I mean, if we toured the Sequoia plant yesterday, and the amount of security at that place is incredible. The concerns they have, you know, these guys you know, walking around heavily armed and all the different things they have to put in, because, you know, these are potentially terrorist targets. They really are. Now, if you go, we went to a dam, it has some security concerns, but not nearly as significant. You go to a solar facility, you go to a wind facility, you don't have shoot to kill people there. I mean, it's a whole different way of generating power and thinking about that. And so that security infrastructure being spread over a smaller amount of sales, we're not sure. I mean, yes, you would potentially have a lower capital cost, but that does not necessarily mean you're going to end up with a lower cost per kilowatt hour of electricity production. And I think that that is going to be a very significant hurdle for this technology to get over. The other is, and you know, to Dan's credit, he says if we stay on track, and he gave a very, I think, aggressive agenda for being able to take a licensed design that the NRC doesn't even have yet and get it through the NRC process and then ultimately get a bunch of people to sign up to take on a, you know, Generation 1 reactor. My experience with most of the utilities that I've dealt with is they like to be first to be like fourth or fifth. They're not angling to become sort of the first one that rolls one of these things out. TVA is unique because there's been some political pressure, I think, put on TVA to accept this thing and sort of go along with it a little bit. We'll see how far it actually goes. We're going to have a process at TVA where TVA is doing an integrated resource plan where they start looking at sort of the next 20 years. And it's my understanding that they're actually going to try to introduce some of the projected cost numbers for the SMRs into that and see if it can actually play in an energy portfolio going forward. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, no one really knows where the cost points of these things are going to be. They're all highly speculative. And having seen the amount of trouble and license modifications that the NRC has done to just the AP1000, which is much more similar to the current sort of fleet of reactors as opposed to what an SMR is going to be, I think it is incredibly optimistic to think that the NRC could actually take this, run it through their system, and crank it out the other side in 3 years.
Steve, here's my question then. What is our alternative? And let me sort of continue with the earlier narrative. Florida has essentially the greatest challenges on all fronts. We closed one of our five nuclear plants. We are overly reliant on natural gas. Duke Energy in particular, about 70% natural gas. The state as a whole, over 60% natural gas. How do you move us, as you've talked about in your opening remarks, from a big box utility model to one that, and feasibly so, without overburdening the consumers, to incentivize them in a different way? And what does that look like?
Absolutely. So my crystal ball would be that, first of all, natural gas, being over-reliant on natural gas right now is actually not a problem because gas is so cheap. And so it's really not hurting anybody in the sense of, from a financial point of view, to be dependent on gas. And there's a lot of debate about where future gas prices are going. But I think because of this tremendous amount of gas that has been brought into the market, particularly in the United States, I don't believe the gas prices are going to be anything like the historic volatility that we've seen for, say, the next 5 years. Now, if you start getting 5 years and beyond, we'll see where that goes. So I think we actually have a window here where someplace like Florida or other utilities that are investing in gas right now, I don't think the risk scenario that we've seen of historic volatility of gas is actually as much of a concern, say, for the next 5 years. What's happening over that five-year period is that you're going to see more and more market penetration of renewables, and you're going to see the price points of renewables continue to improve. And the other beauty is that natural gas and renewables actually can play relatively well together because gas has a lot more flexibility than your traditional baseline load units that you have like coal or a nuclear plant. You can't swing coal and nuclear plants as much as you can swing a gas plant, and you can even design turbines to even ramp and swing more aggressively to follow the intermittency of renewables. At the same time, we're going to see an increased penetration of electric vehicles, and we're going to see an increased climbing the learning curve on storage options with batteries and other things like that, which is then going to be able to also provide some backup to the intermittency of renewables and is going to take out a lot of that question. You're going to start to see these hybrid things going on. I was in California last week, sat down, had lunch with Lyndon Reeves, who is the head of SolarCity. He's the executive, and his cousin is Elon Musk, who's doing Tesla and everything. And Lyndon they are now the largest solar company as far as rolling out solar on residential homes. And their whole business model is to go in and do either third-party leasing or do third-party PPAs. And you give them access to the market in Florida, he's drooling to get into the market. There's some tax issues that need to be dealt with and other things as far as tangible and property tax, but those things are overcome. So you're going to see entrepreneurial investment that is going to come into a lot of these utilities and start to give customers options where it's not going to be on the utilities dime, it's not going to be on the ratepayers dime. They're actually going to be able to come in and offer it cheaper. They're going to be able to offer customers savings. And that's why you're seeing in a number of jurisdictions, places like SolarCity and Sunrun and others come in and really compete. So when you start you have natural gas, you start seeing renewables like solar, you start seeing continued penetration and investment in energy efficiency. You go to Home Depot right now, you go to Lowe's, you're no longer just seeing compact fluorescents. You're beginning to see LEDs, which are taking the energy efficiency to a whole other level in the lighting sector and other things, and you're seeing increased penetration, and I think we're going to continue to see movement there. So I don't believe that the theory that you have to have a nuclear plant or a coal plant to be able to play with gas is necessarily going to be the future we're dealing with. I think gas is going to become the dominant resource, and then you're going to see renewables and efficiency continue to grow and begin to fill out, and you're going to see continued retirements of coal plants, and you're going to see the nuclear renaissance continue to sort of dissipate completely.
Well, if we're relying more and more on natural gas, again in Florida, the issue raised was about the vulnerability of the pipeline system and the volatility of gas prices. Mark Cooper, who wasn't able to join us today, has argued that gas prices haven't even been volatile. You had a couple of spikes. So, Richard, can you sort of characterize for us, has natural gas been volatile, and is this abundance of supply, has it eliminated the volatility? And third, how vulnerable is our pipeline system?
Sure. That I think that as we look forward over the next 5 to 10 years and try to assess, you know, what do these natural gas resources mean? You know, what are the tangible benefits that we can rely upon for natural gas? And as we think about prices going forward and the affordability and potential market stability of natural gas, I think looking back over the last 10 years is not quite the most helpful view. The reason is a number of reasons. One, certainly the rise in natural gas production driven by new technologies on the production side. We're talking hydraulic fracturing combined with horizontal drilling has led to this, those sorts of innovations has led to this tremendous growth in accessible and affordable natural gas resources. Underlying that reality is an extensive pipeline network that brings gas from production areas to markets. We're talking 2.4 million miles of natural gas pipeline in the country. This is the envy of the world. We also have significant natural gas storage assets. We added 1 trillion cubic feet of underground storage capacity over the last 10 years. So while we have new and affordable resources, we also have the infrastructure in place that is able to meet demand when there is demand and store it when there isn't and respond to swings in demand when necessary. As a result, I think that from our work that we've done at AGA, assessing the kind of plausible likelihoods of different scenarios of natural gas demand going forward, and You know, we did a study last year on market stability, and what we wanted to understand was if we start using natural gas in all these different ways, we start increasing natural gas for power production, the possibility of, while not excessive, but quite a bit of LNG exports out overseas, thinking about increasing our use of natural gas for as a transportation fuel, as well as in for industry and residential commercial uses. You know, you start stacking this up, and the idea is, well, aren't we going to break the market? And we actually come out on the other side, that we see that this robust resource supported by this infrastructure can lead to a stable natural gas market within a $4 to $6.50 price range. So we don't predict natural gas prices, but we do see a range of plausible scenarios that lead to that outcome. And that's where we kind of stick our flag on the ground and say this to us represents relative market stability, especially compared to what we saw over the last 10 years. But there have been some changes in the marketplace that, looking back over those 10 years and the volatile marketplace that we saw, isn't necessarily the appropriate lens through which to view the next 10. The other question was about pipelines, and you said vulnerability, and you can take vulnerability in a lot of different cases. I can't speak to the Florida situation. I don't know necessarily those specifics, but again, we have the most robust pipeline infrastructure in the world here in the U.S., but there are continuing issues that are currently being addressed. One such example is up in the Northeast, and the questions around the coordination between the natural gas system and the electric system. And the fear is that there is insufficient infrastructure to meet high levels of natural gas demand in localized areas, in particular in the far Northeast, during times in the winter when natural gas consumption spikes as a result of demand for heating. It gets cold, you turn on your heater. So these residential, commercial, businesses and customers, they start using more natural gas. But simultaneous to that, in the Northeast, there's been a switch away from coal and other fuels towards natural gas. So now there is a new reliance in the electricity generation sector on natural gas. And how do we coordinate these systems such that the temporary price spikes that we've seen in the Northeast during a couple days during the winter, how do we address those and how do we avoid those? Now, keep in mind that when we talk about price spikes, these are localized increases in pricing that are driven by capacity constraints on the transmission system. This is not the commodity that we're talking about coming out, at the wellhead and then at these trading zones. Those prices have stayed relatively flat and stable over the last 4 years, really within that price band that we're talking about. But in local areas where there are infrastructure constraints, we can see temporary price spikes. And, AGA right now is working with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. My colleague Andrew Soto just commended them for their leadership on addressing these issues of natural gas and electric coordination in the Northeast. And this issue could possibly emerge in other places as well. So that's I think, one area that will continue to be a concern, but that we're very actively involved in addressing.
Thanks, Richard. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and open up the floor to questions. Again, we want to start with journalists. Please try to formulate questions more so than commentary, and identify yourself as you raise your question. Yes.
My name is Bobby McGill. I'm a science writer for Climate Central in New York. I've lived in or on the edge of natural gas and oil production field in Colorado for much of the last 8 years until just recently. And there are tremendous concerns about the impacts of natural gas production, specifically fracking and the air and water contamination, possible air and water contamination that comes with that habitat fragmentation. This is a resource that is literally produced in people's backyards, sometimes whether they want it or not. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of those environmental concerns and how those are best addressed, in your opinion, and whether or not the advantages of burning natural gas on the consumer end are outweighed by the environmental impacts on the production end.
Sure. Nice to see you, Bobby. It's Certainly that there are, as the natural gas industry has changed and where we're producing natural gas has created a host of new concerns within within certain communities where this where production is taking place. From the gas utilities perspective, our companies are not the ones producing the natural gas, as I mentioned earlier, but of course it really does matter where the gas comes from for us. I mean, we want to ensure safe and responsible production of natural gas. And so insofar that, you know, we work and communicate with the other segments of the industry, we really do encourage, safe and responsible practices and the sustainable production of natural gas. We have set out a number of policy principles regarding responsible resource development, and I'd be happy to share those with you. I can't get into too many specifics because we could spend all day on this, but what I will say is that natural gas production is an industrial process. This has an environmental footprint. It has a social footprint. And we need fact-based conversations supported by science to understand what those impacts are and help inform policymakers, help inform communities, and get all the stakeholders involved such that we can work to responsibly reduce these environmental and social impacts, while also acknowledging that there is a tremendous benefit from producing natural gas and ultimately consuming it. In terms of consumption in your household, if you have a natural gas water heater, that is by far the most efficient way to heat your water, by far and away better than any other alternative, whether it's electricity or fuel oil or whatnot. There are a whole host of other high-efficiency natural gas applications that can be done. And so when you weigh those benefits and benefits on the electric generation side and the CO2 emission reductions that I mentioned earlier, those have to be part of the equation. But that does not negate the real impacts that there are upstream and the conversations that need to be had and the regulatory apparatuses that should be in place in order to manage these.
Can I just want to add a couple of points. First, I would take issue with the most efficient way of. I mean, I think solar hot water has. I have it on my house, and it works. It works great. And so it's. But the fracking issue is one that we've struggled with as an organization, and let me tell you sort of where we've come down. I think that there needs to be a more aggressive regulatory regime on fracking. And I think that we're seeing sort of mixed signals from the industry about whether they're actually going to accept that. Some say they will. Our biggest fear is some of these smaller companies that are trying to go out in some of these gas field plays and try to make a quick buck. And when we've talked to some of the larger companies, they seem to be a little more comfortable with actually dealing with the regulatory and doing the proper procedures and protocols and making sure that you don't have the issues. There's obviously a lot of water that's used in it. There's a lot of concern there. And I think those are primarily localized issues and they need to be addressed. But I do believe there's a way to properly regulate the way that the fields are being done. Our biggest concern, to be honest with you, with natural gas is the methane leakage. And, as mentioned earlier, we don't believe that this country that we really do have the handle on the methane leakage that we need to. And whether gas is as good of a play in responding to sort of our current portfolio and how it stacks up against coal depends tremendously on the full life cycle leakage rates. And there's been a study that the Environmental Defense Fund and some of the folks at ANGA and some of the gas industry folks are doing that is trying to sort of pin that number down. EPA's got some numbers. There's some folks out of Cornell that have wildly different numbers. And so we believe that there really needs to be more focus on trying to figure out the methane leakage because, as everyone knows, methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas. And so while you may be getting carbon CO2 or carbon dioxide reductions after you burn it, you may actually be ending up losing most, if not all of those, basically because of the upstream losses of methane and its potency as a natural, as a greenhouse gas. So that's something we need to be very concerned about.
Shielded by having that monopoly structure, as opposed to, say, up in New York where and New England and the Midwest, where you have the ISO and your regulated market. And in those areas, you can see power.
And I guess if I can piggyback on that and toss it to Dan, I mean, particularly as Steve has raised these issues of transitioning the incentive for utilities to do something other than just build big box power plants, where in the context of this regulated system, I mean, what do you do as a utility? Can it work to shift the model, or are we going to shift the other way to more regulation?
You know, it's not an area of my expertise. I want to say the following, though, that these large projects, even gas, they take a long time. They're big projects. These are assets that are going to hang around for decades. And so you want to get it right, and it's valuable to have assets that have more flexibility than in the past, because the world is changing, and especially in energy. So in my case, these small modular reactors do have the ability to load follow, to be varied on a daily basis at what power level they're going to operate at. So that'll be more compatible with renewables. And so if you're a utility and, you know, you're in an area where there's a lot of solar, you know, in that time period from 10 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon, you could back off the nuclear plant and while the solar is generating, as an example. So that's a new feature, more flexibility.
Wait, Dan, you're talking about something that doesn't exist and wouldn't be deployable for probably another decade. How does that play into the current volatility and price pressure on the nuclear power plants?
Well, from a technical perspective, it exists. I mean, I was a submariner. You know, you could go ahead flank. You could go all stop. You know, so the reactors can do that. Even the large reactors can do that. They do it in France. They vary daily. So some utilities have started varying their reactors on a daily basis. Energy Northwest out west, where they have a lot of hydro and solar and wind. So, you know, those are, and so let me bring it back home to TVA. You know, some of these assets that we have are coal plants. We're designed to run 100% power, keep them stable. And our gas plants were designed to be peakers. So during the morning and evening power peak, you'd fire them up, and then you'd shut them back down. Well, as gas prices got low, we dispatched our gas ahead of coal, meaning that the gas was run 100% power, and the coal was backed off. Well, what you have is a plant that wasn't designed efficiently to be operated that way. From a maintenance perspective, that isn't how it was intended to be run. So you have to adapt, and you're dealing with the consequences of running your gas plants full out and cycling your coal plants. So, and that's So all I'm saying is I think that diversity of your generating sources, adding flexibility and robustness into your designs to have that flexibility, are the kind of decisions that you want your utilities to make. If you put all your eggs in the, you know, back to Florida, 70% gas, Steve's recommending you just keep on that path for 5 more years at least. The decisions to have these larger assets, flexible gas, flexible nuclear, if you don't develop those options, and then you find yourself in a world that isn't pleasant, you're going to play the hand you're dealt for a long time till you change your electricity generation infrastructure.
Can I respond to Roger's question?
Quickly, and then we'll get to
that. Yeah, because the reason we don't have deregulation in the Southeast is because Southern Company refused, when FERC went after them to try to set up an ISO, they refused to let access to their transmission lines. And actually, Southern has been one of the strongest opponents of the whole culture of deregulation. And then, you know, when it was very hot in the 90s, you know, unfortunately, Enron really poisoned the well for a lot of, and that sort of hangover is still now. I know in some of the deregulated markets, we're beginning to see years of performance. But if you want to hold on to the vertically integrated utility model and you think that you're going to be able to run these big assets through basically a captured public service commission, which are the situations we have in the Southeast, you don't want to see deregulation because you're going to try to sort of game that system to your advantage to try to move these big assets. And so Southern right now is moving Kemper, which is this IGCC lignite facility in Memphis, in Mississippi, they're trying to do. And then they've got their Vogtle plant, and they're using the regulatory structure to try to move these multi-billion dollar projects through so that they get that guaranteed rate of return for a long time. If they were to set up an independent system operator and have their transmission lines fully accessible, and then they were to spin off their generation assets in a deregulated market, they don't want to do that. So that's one of the reasons that we don't have a deregulated market in the Southeast. And the other thing, because we don't have the deregulated market, the nuclear power industry, when they were pushing the nuclear renaissance, that's why the vast majority of the nuclear power plants were targeted for the Southeast. I think we had 18 at some point, was because you had, again, this captured regulatory environment. The number of states, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina, have all played around with early cost recovery where they can actually get money to shift the risk off of the shareholders of the companies onto the ratepayers of these utilities. And it was a total market distortion that allowed something that is a non-competitive asset, nuclear power, which Wall Street doesn't want to touch it, and all these other kind of things, to be able to play in there because of the way that that structure was done. So I think that deregulation would have certain advantages. It also has certain risk. Unfortunately, the political dynamics in the South are just not at this point now that people understand the advantages, and you've got these dominant utility players who don't want to give up the cash cows they've got of these monopoly markets.
Yeah, thanks. My name is Simon Rasmussen. I'm from the Danish newspaper called Berlingske. I had a question about the impact of this natural gas, the boom in natural gas production, on renewables. You sort of touched upon it, Richard sort of touched upon it, but I would like to hear what you think, Stephen and Dan, about that changing the profitability of the business model of actually shifting to renewables if gas prices have, you know, dramatically in the past, let's say, 5 years. So I was wondering if you feel a difference, like you say 3 years ago maybe, and now in the willingness and the amount of interest in renewable energy after the boom in natural gas.
So the question he's asking is, with these low natural gas prices, what is really essentially the incentive to make this shift to renewables?
Well, where we've seen it manifest itself most is that when utilities are looking at whether it makes sense to do renewables, they always want to try to compare it against what they call their avoided cost. And so if the price of natural gas drops, what that does is the next increment of generation, what renewables is benchmarked against is lower. And so there's no doubt that that is putting pressure, and that there is been some backing off of investment in renewables because they're forcing renewables to have to compete against the floor is lower now. But because of the concerns of over-reliance on gas, and because a number of states in the United States continues to have implemented renewable energy requirements, the market continues to be very good. And because there is a production tax credit for these, so there's some tax favorabilities, renewables are still very, very competitive. The good news about renewable energy is that the trends continue to go down. So even as natural gas prices have brought the floor down, renewables are continuing to chase that floor in a competitive way. All the other generation technologies are going the opposite direction. Nuclear power plants, prices are skyrocketing. Coal prices are going up and skyrocketing. And I believe that ultimately natural gas prices will rise. And so as you start to move further out in the planning horizon, as gas prices go up, renewables are going to become increasingly more competitive. And so it has had an impact in the short run, but because of some of the requirements and because of the overwhelming popularity of this, renewables continues to be competitive, and renewables can chase the floor where the other technologies can't.
And Dan, adding to it, especially in the case of the small modular reactors, with natural gas prices where they are, the impact on the renewables as well as on developing a small modular reactor.
I think it matters. But you know, TVA's vision is to be one of the nation's leaders in low cost and cleaner energy, and so. You know, the natural gas is one of the key players in the low cost in terms of new generation. In terms of our current operating assets, nuclear continues to be one of our lowest production costs. But in terms of new generation, you're comparing small modular reactor with gas with renewables, it makes a difference in terms of the low cost. In terms of clean, SMRs remain more competitive than wind and solar. So, you know, there's this broader portfolio and the diversity that all has to factor into your decision making, and so it has an effect, but it isn't an all or nothing thing from our perspective.
I just want to take a quick opportunity to break out of just the electric generation mindset and think a little bit about how there are opportunities for natural gas and renewables to work together in other applications. You mentioned the solar water heaters, and I didn't kind of include that in my assessment of how natural gas is the most efficient water heater. Certainly solar is there. There are cost issues still, but nevertheless, it is a tremendous technology, and a lot of gas utilities, especially up in the Northwest, are thinking about how can natural gas and solar hot water hybrid technologies work together. Because you know, while you can, I mean, now if you could combine those two, that would be the ultimate in terms of hot water energy efficiency. So, you know, we're looking at how natural gas can support technologies such as hot water heaters. Also, there's another example just within the last couple months of a net zero energy home in Utah. This was a really interesting example of a home. It's a demo home. I think it was built by Garbutt, and it was rated and achieves a net zero energy efficiency. But this is the first home that does this in a cold climate. It does this through three principal methods: building design efficiency, which is best in class, basically, on-site solar PV. So it's generating renewable electricity on site, but it also utilizes high efficiency, super high efficiency natural gas appliances. This helps support meeting those energy demands, especially during those coldest months of the year. And when you acknowledge the fact that the natural gas distribution system, which is 92% efficient from the point of production to the point it comes to the consumer, and leveraging that upstream efficiency and incorporating that in how you calculate your net zero energy efficiency and how you net out the on-site energy requirements from what you're taking off the grid, and you kind of formulate that all together. You have this really great example of a net zero energy home that's relying on high efficiency natural gas, on-site renewables, and really great building efficiency design. So there are other examples outside of electric generation system that I just want to point out there.
Yeah, and when I was out in California, we met with Governor Jerry Brown, and California now is, California tends to be a bellwether for where we sort of go with clean cars and all these other things. They're actually now going, their building code standard is now requiring, in the future, net zero energy home building. And so what you're going to see is you're going to see more and more of the new stock being able to really be able to come out in this sort of net zero kind of way, which completely changes the utility paradigm about what load growth is going to look like in the future.
Yes?
Steve here, I guess Nuclear Energy Institute. One thing, Steve, I have a question that I'd like to say, but on the question, in the scenario that you laid out here where you kind of are embracing natural gas, you're concerned about methane, you talked about cost equations, how long are you going to advocate continuation of the production tax credit for renewables? Because you talk about competitiveness, but every time we turn around, we hear that the future of renewables lives and dies on production tax credit.
Well, the reality is that when you look at the price points for PV panels, you look at what's going on with the technology advancements in wind, we actually are having conversations with both the leaders in those industries, and they're actually modeling how they're able to compete without the production tax credit. So the 30% tax credit on solar ends in 2016. The industry is going to argue that they'd like to bridge that a little longer and then step it down so there's not a cliff. Anybody that's been following this knows that the wind production tax credit has just created just this, boom bust cycle in wind. But again, the wind capacity factors, the technology improvements, all these things, even without the production tax credit, are, as you look at the forward forecast, they're in the money. So this is what is so incredible about the renewable technology is that they can continue to chase on a downward trajectory where we're going, whereas the nuclear power is going to have a production tax credit, I think, to be competitive, and it's questionable about how that's going to play out. And we have real concerns about greenhouse gases, and but again, we do not believe that nuclear power is a solution to global warming. And the primary reason for that is that you're not going to deploy nuclear technology, we believe, in all the areas of the world that are going to need energy production going forward. This country has a very stable grid. We have a lot of the infrastructure. We have a lot of things going. But when you look at where a lot of the growth is going to take place across the world, you're not going to be deploying nuclear technology in places like Indonesia and Somalia and all these other places that are have potentially less stable government structures because of the nuclear proliferation. So when we think about nuclear power, we think about Wall Street. Wall Street doesn't want to invest in it because it's too costly and they have to have the government support and subsidies to do it, and it can't compete in competitive markets. We talk about Wall Street, water, weapons, and waste. Wall Street, the water, a lot of these facilities are incredible water users, and there's a lot of constraints, and we're going to see that further get exacerbated with climate change. The weapons issue, this proliferation issue, is very real. We're seeing the discussions in Iran. We're seeing it in North Korea, where they're using commercial nuclear power technology as a pathway to get weapons, and that continues to be a very, very vexing problem for this technology. And I think if you're going to try to use nuclear power to solve global warming, you're going to have to unleash this technology in more and more destabilized places, and I don't think that we're going to go there because of the concerns of proliferation. And then the industry still hasn't solved the waste issue, and we've been promised that from the days of Edward Teller, that there's going to be a solution for nuclear waste, and it sort of jumps all around from, saying, hey, we're going to bury it in the ground, to where we're going to basically try to do a reprocessing, which has just a plethora of very serious concerns about it. So we don't believe that nuclear power is going to be a solution for global warming. Our organization is not out there clamoring to shut down all the nuclear power plants. There are organizations that are out there like that. And, you know, what I think is going to be the challenge is as these plants age and you've got to take them offline, what do you replace them with? And so we don't actually see nuclear power gaining market share in any measurable way across the world, and you can see those trends already happening. I think the question, though, is there a role for another generation of nuclear power plants to try to sort of prop up the existing nuclear power plant infrastructure across the world, and how quickly are we going to back off that? And that, to me, is the question. So I don't see nuclear power growing, but I'm not quite sure what we're going to do when you start seeing a lot of these plants coming offline. That's going
to
be a real problem.
Well, you know, and we've got a couple extra minutes because of the delayed start. But just an interesting fact from Florida in that regard. James Fenton, the director of the Florida Solar Energy Center, by his calculations, even in Florida, which has much lower rates than the Northeast, his estimation was that the day after the current tax credits expire, that solar will be cheaper than the average residential rate in the state of Florida, and so you could actually do it without the tax credit. And then by 2025, his estimation is that solar would be half the cost of residential electricity in Florida, which would seem to suggest that you wouldn't need the tax credit. And if it were there, then it would obviously have a greater impact. But with the last few minutes left, were there any other? Yes.
Mark, you're a retired director of the International Space Station Program, returning to my roots in environmental conservation and renewable energy industry. And my question, I think largely for Stephen, is I've been down this yellow brick road already as a producer in the solar energy industry. And seeing the bottom fall out of the industry in the early 80s because of an inability to meet demand, an inability to even scratch the surface of industrial and urban energy demand, which is measured in gigawatt hours, not kilowatt hours. So could you comment a little bit on the market penetration that you project? And is that measured in decimal points or in tens of
percent? We actually are talking about gigawatt hour penetration of and gigawatt capacity penetration of solar. And what you're seeing is Georgia, just in this past IRP, the commission mandated 525 megawatts of solar, and they had done another 200 or so before that. And so you're at, Georgia over the next 3 years is going to be at 750 megawatts of solar. So they're approaching a gigawatt in real time as we're talking. We believe that the TVA, if they would, get out of their sort of current capital crunch and start looking longer term, is going to be starting to be able to put out gigawatt targets. We're already seeing, I think they're already over a gigawatt in North Carolina. So what you dealt with in the 1980s is fundamentally different than what's happening today. I would encourage you to look at Amory Lovins, Rocky Mountain Institute. They have a thing called Reinventing Fire, and they've basically taken regional models and they've looked at how do you actually scale up renewable energy, because they ultimately are saying we're going to be off of coal plants and we're going to be off of nuclear plants by 2050, and they're actually going to back down the reliance on natural gas, and a lot of that is going to be filled in with efficiency and renewables, and they sort of spell out how do you do that gigawatt rollout that you're looking at. It's a fundamentally different world. I mean, I appreciate the folks that jumped into it early, were the early adopters and all that kind of stuff. But if you look at the price points for solar and you look at the penetration rates and you look at what some of these innovative entrepreneurs are doing, it's a whole different world than what it was 30 years ago.
We have time for about one more question. Okay. Any other questions?
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your participation and appreciate your attentiveness to this session. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Great.